Hello, 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 and welcome to the My Empty Hands podcast, a conversation with martial artists and about martial arts with a focus on Kenpo, but, you know, hey, we may touch on other things as well. I'm Reggie Darden, and today I'm going to be chatting with Shinigami, just going to find out about his journey and whatever else we happen to come across, we'll chit chat about it. So usually I kind of start these off by kind of giving my background. I think I'm going to start kind of changing that up, and we'll just kind of jump right into our guest here. So, go ahead and tell me and our listeners, how did you get started in the martial arts, and you know, how did it find you, and just tell us about kind of the start of your journey.
I grew up watching a lot of anime. I think a lot of us did. I used to get bullied a lot, so I wanted to learn something eventually. When I went to culinary school, I was kind of bigger than I was in middle school in the first couple years of high school, so senior year, people kind of stopped messing with me. Hmm. So I was kind of thought I was all right. Then I got in a couple of fights in culinary school with this one dude who kept messing with me, like pranking me and stuff. And I realized that I need to learn something still. And then I was living in Pasadena, and then I was living in Hollywood for a little bit with my uncle. And there was a kung fu school right there on Vermont, right between Lexington and I think Sunset. I can't remember. I can't remember exactly what street, but I would watch them a little bit, and then one day the Sifu called me in, Sifu Earl White, and I trained there for like 2 weeks before I moved back to Palmdale. And when I came back to Palmdale, Lancaster area, I looked for a martial arts school for a while, and something that would kind of fit my budget and kind of had some decent technique and everything. I just wanted to learn how to defend myself. Hmm. And then I ended up getting invited to go to this place out in my hometown, Lake LA, which is like just east of Lancaster proper. And try out this karate class he was going to. So I went and I kind of fell in love with it. And the base art there is American Kenpo. But we combined it with Shotokan kata because it was kind of originally a Shotokan school. My Shion took it over. And well, he's an associate master now. But he took it over and kept the Shotokan kata because, one, it does better at open style tournaments. And two, it was easier to kind of keep something that the students already had familiarity with and then work the Kenpo in. He's also got black belt in Shotokan anyways, and a couple other black belts and some other stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got into it. I ended up just sticking with it. And 17 years later, I'm a second degree black belt. And that's, of course, you know, after 3 years of COVID shut down, and then like it closed mm-hmm. temporary for a couple years before that. And then one of the other senseis helped bring it back a couple years back in 2013. You know, 17 years, give or take, about six, where I was kind of doing my own thing.
Gotcha.
Due to circumstances.
Gotcha. Now, just going back to that first teacher, do you recall what system that very first teacher was?
It was Kun Hop Kwon Do, Kung Fu. They also taught Kaji Kembo and, like, African dance, and had, like, the hidden connection between African dance and combat.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting. Right on. So when you found the Kenpo school, was there something that particularly drew you to that particular school, or just that was the one that was convenient to get to, or?
I mean, it wasn't really a matter of convenience. It was just that I tried it out, and I liked the environment. It was very, very, felt very welcoming. And the techniques, like, we jumped right into doing actual techniques, pretty much. You know, we'd warm up. We've pretty much still follow the same warm. We'd warm up, do all the basic, like, star block set, punches, kicks, all that. And then we'd do a little bit of Shotokan kata, and we'd separate out by belt level and do different katas per belt level. And then we would jump right into the Kenpo techniques. And I don't know, just something about it that felt really, just really practical immediately. And I just stuck with it. Stuck with it. It worked. It was the environment and just the technical side of it just clicked for me, like, right away.
Gotcha. And at that school, is there any other elements of the Shotokan that was integrated into the system, or is it split, or?
Occasionally we'd work on some of the Bunkai from some of the kata, but we didn't focus on that too much. It was kind of like, just in case you guys go to an actual Shotokan school, if you move away and that's all you can find, you guys need to know a little bit of the Bunkai so that, you know, they know you learn some legitimate Shotokan besides just the base kata. Hmm. But, you know, the main focus was the Kenpo for the self-defense.
Okay, gotcha. And then as far as, you know, the Kenpo lineage, are you familiar with kind of the lineage of your instructor? And
yeah, Xian John Ramsey trained under Frank.
Oh, okay.
Very nice. So it's pretty close up the line, almost right under Ed Parker himself, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
Frank, so. Frank Trejo is very, very beloved in the Kenpo community. So yeah, that's a lineage to be from. That's definitely one that is a great lineage to be a part of. So yeah, that's fantastic. So since there are, so sounds like you at your school, there's you know, a focus for competitions, and as I can see in your background there, you got a lot of trophies. So I take
yes,
it
sir.
Competing is a big part of your training, and is that kind of for the school as well, is there
yeah.
a lot of focus on competition, or
Not as much as there used to be, but we do encourage our students to compete. We actually have a tournament in LA coming up on October 13th that we're going to have a bunch of students go to. But the main focus is mostly on the self-defense side. When we do know for sure students are going to go towards competition, we'll take them aside and start training that group for sure. Because not everyone does it. Most of the students are there just to learn some self-defense, and a lot of their parents just kind of stick them in there. Because there's not a lot of things to do out here in Lake LA, and it's one of the few positive activities that the youth can engage in. So we tend to, you know, just level it around who actually we know is going to kind of compete, get a sense for who's going to want to do it. We'll announce tournaments, we'll get a list of names, and we'll work on them for the kata and the point sparring and all that.
Do you play, do you compete in both, you know, forms and sparring, or is it just, or do you just do,
yeah,
you know,
one? We generally do both forms and sparring. You know, it's one, just because that's, you're going to be there all day anyway, and you might as well do forms because you're going to be stuck all day waiting for fighting and have nothing to do if you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And then two, it's just good to have another layer of competition and have something that's not necessarily, because not everyone's good at the sparring side, not everyone's good at the kata side. So sometimes it's good to do both and figure out where you land. And some students will just start focusing more on the katas, the weapons katas, all that. And others will start leaning more towards focusing on fighting. I kind of focus more on the sparring myself, going more into it. But I did get plenty of those from doing katas and even like self-defense demonstration divisions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you would prefer the sparring over the kata?
Yeah,
or
for sure. Yeah. Just mainly for the fact that I feel like even point sparring, for all the guff it gets from more full contact style guys, there's value in it beyond the kata, because you're kind of dealing with someone still trying to hit you. And that helps you prepare for the reality of someone trying to hit you, whether or not it's tapping you or actually trying to knock your block off.
Mm-hmm.
It also builds speed, timing, accuracy, things that you can implement when you need them in a practical situation. That is more, especially since, again, all our self-defense comes out of the American Kenpo system rather than the Shotokan forms we use for competition. It, you know, I feel like the kata is more of a active meditation that you can use as a competition.
Hmm.
Gotcha. You know, but it's not as useful to the students, in my opinion, as the sparring, because again, that's live resistance. It's a little bit of a pressure test.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Gotcha. Is there a particular form that you prefer when you're competing, or?
I did Konkudai a lot. I did Konkudai a lot. Konkudai and Basadai. And but I'd say probably mostly Konkudai. I won a lot of competitions with that.
Okay. And that's a Shotokan form.
Yeah, it's a Shotokan kata.
What about any Kenpo forms? Did you compete with any of those?
No, I never really competed with any of those because a lot of the more soft style forms don't really do so good at open tournaments where there's a lot of hard style traditional katas most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
One of these days, I'll probably go do an actual Kenpo tournament, and I'll probably do long form four for that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely the go-to. So, right on. So now, before we started recording there, so you mentioned that you got some backyard fighting, or
yeah,
you kind of talk about that and how you got into that.
So I started watching street beefs a long time ago. It came up on my YouTube. I used to watch, even before I started learning martial arts, I used to kind of start watching like videos of street fighting and street attacks and stuff to see what's out there, just to be aware. Because there's a whole huge, massive difference between getting bullied on the schoolyard, even getting jumped at school, and then like someone in the real world where there's, you know, it's a lot more serious. You know, watching that kind of brought up street beefs in the algorithm. I started watching it for a while, and then COVID shut everything down in 2020, and I had just gotten my first degree black belt in September of 2019.
Mm-hmm.
So I had only done a couple of tournaments. I was going to start trying to focus more on the tournaments that's had cash prizes for black belts. And then all that went away. And I wanted to get into full contact MMA for a while. And so they announced they were going to have a West Coast branch of street beefs, because originally it was in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And that's still going on over there. And so I got into the first West Coast event super last minute, got a 4.5 second head kick knockout, and that blew up all over the place. So I ended up being the heavyweight MMA champ in Street Beast West Coast 2 times. I lost it to a dude named Nasty Native. He's doing pro fights now. I'm getting ready to start doing pro fights. I've done a couple of sanctioned amateur fights this year. And 2 years ago, I went to Florida and did one. So that all came about simply because there was no other way to compete at the time. And I thought it was just a good way to get my feet wet and see if I really wanted to eventually pursue a career as a full contact MMA fighter. And that's kind of what I'm doing right now, actually.
Gotcha. Now, so this the street beast. So I assume that they have kind of the same kind of rule set as like a UFC, or do they have a different?
They made some alterations, but yeah, it started pretty much the same exact rules as professional fighting, elbows and knees and all that. Something major enough happens, they'll make tweaks to keep the fighters safer, since it's all volunteers running the thing, and it's nobody's a professional.
Mm-hmm.
They, for example, a fighter named Memnon Warrior did a little flying knee. It wasn't even a big flying knee, but he broke somebody's jaw, so now knees to the head aren't allowed. And then one of my fights, someone hit me with a 12-6 elbow to the back of the head on the ground. And, you know, so now the West Coast branch doesn't allow elbows on the ground anymore. But for the most part, it was originally pretty much basically professional unified rules, style rules, as far as what was allowed.
Mm-hmm. And is it all just stand up, or you can do ground and grappling, or?
They offer different combat sport styles. If you wanted to do boxing, you can do boxing, kickboxing, Muay Thai. We just started a combat karate division in there a year ago in the West Coast branch. There's MMA. The OGR started their own thing called cage boxing, where elbows are allowed, clinch fighting, and takedowns are allowed, but there's no kicks or ground fighting, and you have to wear elbow pads. There's a lot of different options, and what you get generally depends on who signs up for what. But it's a very unique environment, too. You know, one of the things I find interesting about it is it's very much a community. It started as a way to stop gun violence, to squash beefs in, like, the hood.
Mm-hmm.
It actually started with a couple of guys who knocked on the founder's door asking him if they could just throw hands in his backyard over a drug deal gone bad instead of shooting each other. And so he started putting up flyers, you know, if you got a beef, come settle it. And then it kind of expanded outward into, hey, if you want to go just test yourself as a fighter, just sign up and just come fight. You know, it doesn't have all those hoops you have to jump through to become a sanctioned fighter. So, you know, you just sign up, and if they pick you, you show up and you compete, and they'll match you up with whoever's there that signed up for the same thing. It's close to your weight class and experience level, stuff like that. And like, since I started doing sanctioned fights, like just the way Street Beefs has run, I kind of feel like it's better in a lot of ways, simply because it's very much a community. You get a real sense of community after your first time. The first time, everybody's nervous because, like, I'm in some dude's backyard. There's all these guys here that look like they know what they're doing. You know, some of these guys look like they just got out of prison. What am I doing here? But then everyone starts talking to each other and everything and hanging out the whole day. And, you know, you get to fight. It's usually done during the day. So you get to fight, especially if you're more of a name, you get to fight earlier and enjoy the rest of the fights all day versus doing sanctioned fights where you're kind of in the back waiting for hours. My last one, my fight didn't come up till almost midnight. I was waiting so long, you know. So I think in certain ways it's better. And other ways I get why sanctioned fights don't run that way, but in a lot of ways it is better. And it's a good place to start if you don't want to, you know, shell out all that money to get licensed to fight. And maybe find out you don't really want to be in there dealing with the getting punched in the face full force.
Now, is there a, you know, situation where, you know, let me go back. So this is, you know, you have gloves and whatnot, or.
Yeah.
Okay. And then. Do, you know, I would think that, you know, with the fighting, sometimes, you know, tempers flare up and people kind of go off script, so to speak. Is there a lot of that kind of thing going on, or?
No, that really doesn't happen. Believe it or not, that happens a lot less at Street Beefs events. I don't think I've really seen too much of that. I know the very first one, because it was in one of the fighters' backyard, the very first Street Beefs West Coast, and he lost the guy whose backyard it was lost the decision, and his homie got kind of heated and started yelling about stuff. But I really don't recall anything other than that happening. And it's actually funny, the last sanctioned fight I did, that happened a lot more in the audience over the outcome of some of the fights. The judges were making some bad calls that night, and it actually caused a couple of fights in the audience to the point where people were getting tased. It was crazy. Like, you could hear the taser going off in the locker room. It was wild.
Gotcha. Now, so with the popularity of the UFC, are the fighters, are they trying, is there a lot of people that are trying to kind of get recognized and you know, try and be a character, you know, so to speak? Is there a sense of that, or is there, you know, a lot of people that are maybe doing more than they need to in an attempt to try and get seen and try and be, you know, viral or whatnot?
I think it's a mixed bag. There's several guys that have, like I said, have moved on in professional fighting. One of the guys who was one of the West Coast branch OGs that was at the first event, his ring name is Mook. He actually did a kickboxing match against Anderson Silva's son, like a sanctioned one, and won that. He holds two titles right now in kickboxing and Muay Thai, actually sanctioned. And then on the other end of the spectrum, kind of in the middle, there's me, because I went there in a gi top with my black belt on and a big old Kempo patch on my back. But I was also way overweight at the time. So people were like heckling me and stuff. Like, I didn't hear that because I was focused on the fight. And then that was kind of like the perfect storm to go viral, because the other guy had like a Venom rash guard and looked like, you know, Muay Thai shorts and Venom gloves, and looked like he was kitted out and had trained like you know, at the MMA gym in the middle of town where all the real fighters come from. And I looked like some McDojo guy from down the strip mall. And I got a knockout. I went viral, not even trying to. And then you have guys like Fairplay who came in and also wore a gi, but did like flashy kicks and were knocking people out and just beating everybody, even by decision. And a more recent example is the other end of the spectrum where they're just so out there that they're popular just because they're a train wreck. And that's this dude named Death Sentence, who doesn't fight very well, hasn't won a fight, but he comes in there super confident every time. We get to do our own intros too. I think that's one thing that separates that out and kind of is what gives people that potential to go viral if they say the right thing or have the right look or do whatever, whether it's for the right reasons or the wrong reasons. But he comes out and he's like, "My name is Death Sentence and I'm gonna finish this in 2 seconds." And then he does this weird flying leap with some kind of, not to sound sexist or anything, but kind of girly flailing windmill hammer fists. And then proceeds to basically get starched at the end of the fight, but or just dog walked the whole time while he's just flailing his arms all over the place, trying to hit whatever he can, wearing a Naruto headband and like a Naruto belt and like a black leotard, like unit skin tart, like I don't know what to call it. It's not really like a leotard, but it's like a something. You ever look him up, you'll see what I'm talking about. Gotcha. But you know, he's a character. Character, so people love to watch his fights. His fights get somehow he has more Instagram followers than me. He's got like 70,000 Instagram followers, but it's because he's a train wreck. You know, you can't look away. Yeah, so that's where it goes. It's also like a there was actually another interesting story about it, kind of to highlight how it's just also just like a platform if you want to use it for that. There was a dude who had a plumbing business. He went to the OG yard. He fought 2 times and his ring name was his plumbing business name. So he went there to promote his plumbing business. Fought twice and that was it.
Yeah.
Then you get guys like Baby Hulk, right? 30 million views and now he's doing pro fights.
Yeah, no, it's just getting out there and getting seen, and, you know. And never really sure what's gonna catch fire, but you know, gotta put it out there in order for a chance for that to happen. So
yeah,
I could see that. So going, so others in your school that are also involved in this, and then secondarily, what is kind of the attitude, feelings about you doing this from one, like the other students, and then, you know, how does your instructor feel about the fighting?
I told him about it when they were going to do it out here, because they actually had come out here from the East Coast to do like a one-time event out here, and I almost went to go do it, but then my car got stolen. I didn't get it back until like a few days later after it was already over. And you know, he was cool with it. He didn't see a problem with it because I showed him some of the videos of how it was ran and everything. But he knew I was trying to eventually move into full contact fighting anyway. My students think it's pretty cool, the ones that have seen it. And I had one student turn 18 and go try it, but he kind of got a little too in his own head. And you know, it was his first time out there. Usually when you do karate tournaments, you're not allowed to coach your students when they're competing. So he's not used to listening to directions while he's fighting. I think that kind of affected things a little bit. But, you know, point was he went out there and did it and gave it a shot. You know, he trained hard for it and started off all right. So, you know, one day when I have my own school, actually, I think it's such a good experience to have that I feel like I'll probably make it a requirement for first degree black belt to do at least one street beef match. Just because I feel like too many people get to a certain point and have never really had to pressure test themselves against someone really trying to knock them out or hurt them or something. And that's a really controlled, very safe environment to do it for the most part. And I trust the community because I've been a part of it for 4 years now. Even though I've kind of moved away from doing it as much, because I was doing it every couple of months and I've only been out there twice this year. But, you know, it's definitely something that I think more martial artists should do is go do a street beast and see where you're really at.
Yeah, definitely get get that real world experience. Definitely helps with the perspective and seeing where, seeing what works and what doesn't. I mean, obviously there's certain things that we can't do in a controlled environment, but yeah, I can definitely see where that would be beneficial. So going back to your Kenpo training, is there a time or a story that kind of sticks out to you, preferably when you are a colored belt, that just kind of stands out to you, that a story that maybe you want to share with us?
It was kind of funny. I was a green belt. I went to go do a tournament, and Philip Ree was there. I've met a couple of like celebrity martial artists over the course of going to tournaments and stuff. But this one particular year, Philip Ree was at the Orange County Open. He came up to me after I did my self-defense and my point sparring matches. I got first place in both of those. And he was like, "Hey man, you're a really good fighter." I was like, "Thanks." I guess he was trying to cast for a movie, but I couldn't make it to the actual like casting thing. But that was pretty cool. That was probably one of the.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. So, being that, is there any aspirations for getting into, film or TV or anything like that?
It'd be pretty cool if I could get into the movies. I think that's something maybe I could parlay my professional fighting career into if I get big enough. Like if I make it to the UFC, I mean, a lot of those guys get into movies. Look at Conor McGregor. He was just in that, albeit really hokey, remake of Roadhouse. Mm-hmm. But, one of my coaches actually is in a lot of lower budget movies too. And we were actually doing choreography to put me in one. And then there's been some delays in filming, but I might actually be in a movie soon. So, I mean, it's something that'd be cool. I mean, I love watching movies. It'd be cool to be in one,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, exactly. So along with the fighting, are there any inspirations or aspirations for, coaching other fighters, or just want to kind of stick to just fighting yourself? Or
long-term goal is to move the heck out of here, get out of this little desert. It's too small around here, but eventually I'm going to move out of here. I haven't decided where yet, and open my own gym and teach full time. Cause right now I volunteer. It's a little community program at the park, but eventually I do want to teach full time and actually get paid to do it. So I have a lot of ideas. I've trained a lot of places with a lot of instructors and, outside of Kenpo to get ready for MMA and stuff. And I've learned a lot of do's and don'ts and been in really good facilities and been in kind of like, we're just starting from scratch again facilities. And, I've got a pretty good idea what I would like to get to eventually is pretty big. Like the place I started learning jiu-jitsu formally was this place called Premium Fitness, and I was training under Master Kazik Amunez, and he's like a fifth degree under the Gracies, like the Gracies. And that place was nice. It was in an old retail, like a supermarket sized retail spot. So they had a big old mat for jiu-jitsu. They had a whole like regular gym area with all the machines and free weights and everything, big old long turf going almost the whole way, a big huge bag room, a cage, a boxing ring, like a bunch of treadmills and exercise bikes, and they had like TVs where if you were using those you could watch old UFC fights and stuff. So kind of something like that, but I think I'd make it a little bigger so I could have a full-size cage and have two mats so I could run a Kenpo class and a jiu-jitsu class at the same time. That's kind of the goal down the road.
Excellent. So then, besides the Kenpo and the jiu-jitsu, have you been training in any other systems or?
I've dabbled in Muay Thai and boxing a little bit just for MMA purposes. And the coach that helps me with my MMA fight for the last year or so, the one that does movies sometimes. He's a black belt in judo and Japanese jiu-jitsu and a couple of other things. So I'm picking up a little bit of that too while I'm at it. Oh, and so he's a master of sport in sambo. He used to go over and to Europe and do sambo tournaments for like $100,000 cash prizes.
Gotcha.
So
that's a nice payday. So excellent.
Yeah, for sure.
Right on. So since you're in the MMA world, what's your, in relation to Kenpo, where do you see kind of the future of Kenpo in how it relates to where MMA is growing and how it's growing, or where would you like to see it go? Maybe
I think it's got a place. I think it's definitely got a place. It's actually had a place in there since the early days. I don't know if you've ever heard of Keith Hackney.
I was just about to mention him. So, but yeah, yes,
he was the first striking fighter to keep Hoyce Gracie off the ground for more than a minute, and he was an American Kenpo practitioner. Obviously, Chuck Liddell, even though it's more Hawaiian Kenpo, they all kind of have a similar root over there.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of all traced back to kind of the same group of instructors in Hawaii before Ed Parker broke away and made his own thing. And I feel like a lot of the principles work really well, canceling, height, width, and depth, matching distance, all that stuff, Distance control is the most important thing in any situation involving combat, hand-to-hand, but especially sport, because if you control where your range is, and you control the fight, so if you can implement your game effectively from the range you want it at and stifle the other guy's range in the process, and Kenpo's great for that. I mean, that's one of the first things you learn is matching distance and then canceling depth, Excellent. Delayed sword.
Yep. Tried and true delayed sword.
Yeah. Those principles are there. Done. The parries. My dojo does things a little different. We try to keep it more evolved and keep adapting it. There's some places that kept it like exactly the way they were. Their instructors learned it, and there's other places like other dojos that try to evolve it as Ed Parker intended. So we've actually adapted some things. We've actually made some techniques of our own, and our main focus is just the basic parries. It's the mm-hmm. first thing. We work on that constantly, and we even invented a new technique called parries to freedom. So before we even do delayed sword, they're parrying and getting off the line of fire to the outside instead of going right up the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And it works really well. We'll even have them just have someone come in with a jab cross or a jab cross jab and have them just parry it first and see what targets they can get and see what they come up with to do. And it works out really well, because in the real world, as we all know, you're not going to have that perfect punch to do that whole technique perfectly every time, but the parries open up targets. So while we still teach all the other techniques in the system, pretty much, we also adapt some things, change some things, and make sure they're aware that you're not going to finish a technique even if you start with this technique, because that the targets are going to change. A couple of things that I personally feel that we need to start kind of focusing on after going and learning jiu-jitsu was panic grabbing. That's one thing I don't really see addressed a lot. People will grab you. You start hitting them, people are going to grab you. Just if nothing else, to keep from being hit any further. So sometimes your ability to throw strikes when they're grabbing your arm, trying to just hang on for dear life, goes away. So you have to adapt so you can do other things and break those grips and all that stuff. So that's something I've started focusing at like a certain, like when they hit purple belt, I kind of start throwing in that resistance after they learn a technique a couple times.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
It's like, okay, gotcha. So now you're going to do hooking wings, but they're going to grab you. Right? They're after you hit them, they're going to grab you. Just out of panic. And now what are you going to do? Now, here's how you can do this, this, and this to get out of that. Now let's see what you do with it. And eventually, because after purple belt, we really try to start cultivating them and putting their own little spin on it, even to the point where you have to start making up your own for some of your tests after that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very cool. I like it. So got a few little kind of fun questions here as we close in on our time today. First one being, do you have a favorite technique?
I have a couple of them actually. I like shielding hammer because it sets up a good angle for an Uchimata throw into an armbar. So that's a real great, and it's a technique that you can basically modify just a little bit and it'll work in MMA if you get the timing right. Mm-hmm. Even if it's just that first initial hammer fist in and getting that underhook instead of the elbow to the body, it still works really good. Gets you in a good situation, do all kinds of up the middle damage, set up all kinds of throws. It's just a very simple but very versatile entry to do a million other things off. And then a swinging pendulum, just because there's a really cool entry for a rolling knee bar there once you're a little more proficient at certain things. Because it just looks cool. You block the kick, hit them in the groin, elbow them up, and then the next thing you know, they're face down on the ground with their knee getting tweaked. It's great.
sounds good. I like it. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
Well, since we do more Shotokan stuff, I actually really like Konkudai for that. We really don't do too many of the Kempo forms actually right now. The only two we really do is short form 1 and long form 4. I know it's kind of a leap, but we'll have them do short form 1 at the beginning, and then we'll focus more on the Shotokan katas for tournaments and just to kind of get them through the curriculum the way we have it. And then for brown belt, you have to learn long form 4. And then probably the kicking set. Just the kicking set is great. It flows really well. And I got really good at throwing front leg roundhouse kicks, which is how I got that knockout forever ago. And I've dazed a few people with it too. I haven't gotten any more knockouts with it yet because everyone expects it after seeing that video. Everyone's like looking out for that high kick. But once you hit yellow belt, you have to start throwing double roundhouses in it instead of a single front leg roundhouse, and then it stacks up. So the kicking set definitely is one of my favorite things because it's really crucial for a lot of the things I've done since learning it.
Gotcha. I like it. So if there was anyone that you could train with, either living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, who would that be?
Probably Ed Parker himself, for sure. And I think probably everyone's answer probably would also probably be Bruce Lee if we're talking about dead, anyone living or dead. Ed Parker and Bruce Lee would probably be two of the best people to train with because the knowledge and just the outside-the-box thinking you get from both of them would just put you on another level.
Gotcha. I like it. Okay, last question there. In honor of Ed Parker's love of humor, do you have a joke that you'd like to share with us?
Oh boy, jokes. Kind of caught me off guard with that one. Man.
Yeah, it's okay. No worries.
I got a ton of them. I was trying to figure out which one I'm gonna go with here.
Yeah, it kind of gets a lot of people, so I'm still.
Yeah, I got a ton of cheesy dad jokes too.
Those are perfect. a lot of us Kempo guys are all about the dad jokes. So yeah, I'll take one of those.
Yeah. Man, I just can't nail it down.
No, that's all right. No worries. We will table that for another time. I thank you for being on here and telling your stories. I was not familiar with the Street Beast, so I'm gonna have to take a look at that and see what that's all about. So now we are at the point where get the shameless self-promotion. So if there's anything that you want to put out there or say that maybe we hadn't covered, now's your time to throw it out there.
All right, subscribe to my YouTube channel, Shinigami the Reaper. If you like really bad public domain movies, or if you grew up on like Monster Vision with Joe Bob Briggs or Elvira or Sven Gulli. I have a second channel where I've done a little bit of that kind of stuff. I haven't touched it in a while, but I do have some kind of corny, funny riffs on like old black and white public domain movies like Plan 9 from Outer Space and Nosferatu. Oh, I also have several places to get merch. This t-shirt is available on millions.co. Just look up Danny Uribe. And then if you go on Teespring, I have Shinigami's Killer merch. I have a whole line of other shirts, cups, wall banners, magnets, all kinds of stuff. And then also my Instagram, Shinigami the Reaper MMA, and my Twitter, the Reaper MMA.
All right. Well, yes, thank you. Thank you again for being on. And I really enjoyed our time together, and keep on doing great things. And you have a wonderful, wonderful day, evening. We will talk again soon.
All right. For sure, man. Have a good night.
All right. Thank you.